All right, here we go. Overdrive off and running. TSN 1050 on the TSN app, your home smart speaker up on TSN 2. Brian Hazio, Dog, Jeff O'Neill, Jamie Noodles, McLennan. How are we feeling on a Wednesday afternoon?
How's the politicians doing?
Yes, you heard about that, huh?
Well, you heard about that. I mean, I'm getting – whenever I'm calling a game, it's like clockwork. Around 4:05, my like Twitter feed and my phone starts to beep because it's like, all right, these idiots are talking about something ridiculous, and it's who's going to be the mayor of Toronto. And obviously,
it was just pie in the sky type of stuff, but we tossed it out there yesterday. Who on Overdrive, and we even threw in JP and Arad and Jonas, they got zero love. They got zero love. Maybe we didn't throw in JP and Arad. JP's mailing it in anyway. He's not feeling well. But Jonas didn't get a bunch of love. I thought he'd get a ton. He got
none. Too liberal. He's too liberal. That's what it is. People are tired of it. It's like, out, man. Like,
yeah,
out.
Jonas, he had a different platform. Well, he wanted to go all positivity. Right. He wanted, which I actually think might be embraced by some people, but I think people in politics would suggest you can't win based on just saying everything's perfect.
It's lies.
He also wanted to eliminate roads and just have it for bikes.
Yeah,
see, I'm the other way. I'm like, bike lanes gone. Let's
gone. Gone.
I first and foremost, people are writing me like, Noodles would not want to be the mayor because I would be so mad at a lot of things. Like,
well,
you know,
we brought up an important point, Noodles. You hate living here.
I don't.
We thought that was a factor. We thought that was a factor in you not becoming the mayor because you hate it.
That's okay, tough to put on a lawn really sign. I'd rather not be here. Vote
for me,
though.
Oh, my God. That caught me off guard. That's a really funny nugget because now you guys are throwing me under the bus being like, I hate it here. I do not hate it here. This is my home. My family lives here. My work is here. Yes, did I grow up in a different atmosphere? 100%. Would I like to have a little bit of back home out here? Sure. But, you know, in the time I spend out west, there's times where I want to drag some of the east out there too, right? So you change with the older you get, maybe the more spoiled you get in certain situations. I like my situation here. Do I dislike the traffic? Absolutely. We're in a huge city. We're in one of the biggest cities in North America. Like, it's going to be traffic. There's going to be overpopulation. There's going to be all these things that big cities complain about. But no, I don't hate it here. That's really funny that you guys are like, nah, there's a reason why I had like 8% vote or something.
Right, we're
like,
throwing you under the
guy
bus.
Hates it there.
That's politics.
See, that, you guys are Trump.
Hazy, that was your comment, Hazy. That was your
that
comment.
That was my comment. Yeah, I was calling. It was low energy Jonas. It was Lion Jamie McLennan. What did I have for you? Sleepy O. Yeah, Sleepy
O. Oh, my God. That is awesome.
That's what I'm going with. Jonas actually made a very good point. Just lie about everything, and then once you get in, you know, you figure it out from there. You
what's know, say, different about the real world than actually doing that?
Right.
That's true.
I'm going to do this. I got big plans, and I'm thinking about, you know, no traffic. Yeah. Like, that's the best one. There just won't be traffic when I'm the mayor. Yeah. Oh, yeah, what's your plan for that? I'll tell you when I get in. But I've got a real great plan. I got something in my back pocket. There won't be traffic anymore. And I think enough people would say, yeah, I'll give this guy a shot.
Yeah.
You know, traffic, I'm gonna vote based on traffic. And, you know, the hope that somehow this guy's got it all figured
honestly,
out.
Honestly, in reading some of the platforms of some people who are throwing their hat in the ring, like one is like, yeah, defund the police. I'm like, I think they need more police around here considering what the hell's going on.
Well, I think that's going the other way now. Yeah, that like old tweets are starting to pop up. Like, well, we saw you tweet that, you know, a few years ago. What are you thinking now?
Yeah.
Well, you see there's a big bust with fake clothes. Do you see that?
I saw a fentanyl bust, but I didn't see the fake clothes.
Yeah,
like, is it Pacific Mall again?
I just read it before. I just saw that tweet before we came on the air, and it's right around the corner from my house at Kipling in the Queensway, and the goofy logo is called, what's the logo, Hayes? It's called like
Canadian Wholesale Liquidators, like brand. I don't want to say the wrong thing here because I'm just looking at a picture without reading it. But
it's called Brands Gone Wild or something.
That's right, Brands Gone Wild Warehouse Sale.
Yeah, like as if if you didn't think walking into Brands Gone Wild that there was some monkey business going on in there.
I have no
problem.
Okay, so twice I've been to China. when I was playing that Japanese pro hockey league. There's a place called the Silk Market there, and it's basically all knockoffs, right? You go in there. I'm not lying. I had our trainer bring two extra hockey bags. I must have bought 25 pairs of True Religion jeans back there for like $25. And you're bartering. You're like, okay, I'll give you. I have no idea what I'm doing. And then I do the math. I'm like, I just paid $1.50 for that pair of jeans. And I'm grinding the guy down.
Right.
And it was unbelievable. You could buy like Louis Vuitton bags for like $6. But I mean...
They weren't knockoffs.
But they'd look like, this is the crazy part. The True Religion jeans, you guys remember those, the big stitching, and I'm sure you guys had a pair at some point
those.
in your life.
They were obnoxious.
Yeah, those
jeans.
True Religion jeans produced some scary animals. The guy with the True Religion jeans that were a little bit bell-bottomy on the bottom,
yes,
with the white pointy Geppetto shoes, that guy was an animal.
Yes.
Exactly.
He had a chin strap, almost exclusively a chin strap.
Yeah. A chin strap and so much greasy gel in his hair and the Geppetto white pointy shoes. That guy was the biggest cheese ball of life.
That guy was a beautician.
And if there was a fight, you know he was kicking somebody when they were down,
yes,
with those shoes on.
Without knowing why the fight happened or having any association with the fight.
Yeah.
That was always the amazing
thing. The t-shirt
thing.
Was an automatic. What was that brand called that all the cheese balls wore?
Affliction. Wasn't it Affliction?
Affliction right across the chest, and they would rip a slit right up top so their greasy chest hair would be popping out. And that guy was an animal.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, you see, like the fights downtown, man. Like growing up in the city and going downtown,
yeah,
and like you'd see fights break out, and it really was. You had the ability to pinpoint. You could get a sketch artist and say, "Let me just." It's True Religion jeans, white shoes, chin strap. Like I didn't even have to see it. I could tell you who sparked that fight,
dude. In the summertime, it switches: white Under Armour flip flops, a tank top, and board shorts, and that guy wants to brawl.
Yep.
You know what, though? Ron just wrote Ed Hardy. I had 38 Ed Hardy hats.
Ed Hardy was big.
Ed Hardy hats. I don't know if I've ever told you guys this story, but I've got a buddy who's in like clothing and stuff and quite successful. But he had a party in Calgary and Chip and Pepper. Do you remember Chip and Pepper?
Absolutely.
Chip was there. I'll find the picture. It's me and Chip hanging out and drinking vodka out of a sculpture. You pour like an ice sculpture. You pour vodka down. You drink out of the bottom. Like I'm sitting there with Chip from Chip and Pepper.
Chip and Pepper. That's outstanding.
It was unbelievable. But that's the type of brands. And when I was in China, like I went to the Silk Market, tying it back to these knockoff whatever, you know, clothing situations. I wore all of that stuff. Like,
well, how would you know, right? Like, how would you really? If you're wearing the shirt, if you're wearing a pair of jeans, like no one's asking to see a tag or anything. As long as it fits appropriately, it looks all right. You know, it's all good. And that's why, like, these places do business. But naming off all these different clothing lines, it does make it, it's kind of amazing how, like, the big, massive brands just stick around for this long, and they're always relevant, you know, like they're always a part of like the cutting edge fashion. And because it is very difficult to stay, you know, cool basically, and to stay stylish and on brand. And like, speaking of pants, did you guys notice Japan, like they had like kind of bell-bottomy pants last night? I don't know if it was every player, and I've noticed it earlier in the tournament. It just seemed like they had really loose pants at the bottom, like by the cleats, and I don't think that's the style. I don't know.
Maybe Costanza working on it. Like,
I don't know.
It was a different thing.
It just, like, I noticed it a couple times last night. I'm like, those look like aggressively large, like overly baggy pants, and obviously it didn't affect Shohei Ohtani, you know, last night, you know, or Japan for that matter. They end up winning the World Baseball Classic, and we'll get into that extensively later in the hour because it was theater in the ninth. Like, it was truly theater, but it was quite the scene in Japan beating the U.S. last night. The World Baseball Classic, they really made a mark. And we'll get to that a little bit later this hour. The Islanders made a mark last night on the Leafs. I mean, that was a beating. That's the first time all year the Leafs have given up 7 goals in a game. They got beat down 7-2.
But it was 2 games within a game, didn't you think? Like, I went back. I had my game. So then I went back, and you can go on ESPN.com in the States and go right back and watch the game. So I'm watching it. I'm like, it's 1-0 after the first, and it's 1-1. Like, we're 1-1 halfway through the game, and it's kind of like, I know the Islanders play like they – like they're sand out there. Like they try and slow things down. They're aggressive. You know, they're that fourth line goes after you. Like they apply pressure, but that didn't. It got away from it. Like didn't feel halfway through the game when I was watching. I'm like, how did this end up 7-2? You know, right. And then you see it kind of unravel. The empty netter. You can argue whether. Like, I don't like the poll at 6 minutes or whatever. Like, it's a coin flip whether you lose 6-2 or 7-2. But it's just such a clean draw, and it goes right back in the middle of the net. You're like, okay, we're done here. Mm-hmm. Like, throw the goalie back in, and then he allows a late one. So it was a
they
weird game.
They just couldn't avoid
it. Got away from him. That's what
yes,
I thought.
It did, yeah.
They couldn't avoid the Bozo mistake.
Yeah.
They started off well. They were intense. And it's just something where you wonder, is that kind of in their DNA, the gaffe, the Bozo mistake? Blown coverage on the 1-1 goal, and then Liljegren with that, it's an amateur hour play in that league. I mean, you can't just stand there and whiff the puck. It can't happen. And then Camp throws a pizza up the wall to Aston Reese, and then the Marner play to Mitch Marner. Those weren't like
Riley, yeah.
Those weren't like getting barreled over in the corner and outworked on a cycle play. Those were mental gaffes, and they were very costly, and you just wonder what that's all about. The Islanders were desperate. They're in a race. They needed that win, but they couldn't avoid the gaffe last night. And I don't think it's something where you're like, oh my God, the sky is falling, right, and they're not going to be ready for the playoffs. But I think the question is, guys, are we done with the tinkering? Because Dave Poulin mentioned it last night. You got a bunch of shiny new toys, and you're mixing and matching. Maybe it's time to screw that and say, whoever shows me that they want to play the most is going to play, and that's the way it's going to be, because it's not a science experiment with the lines. You got to get something that's cooking, because it's like Austin Matthews looked kind of good with Kerfoot and Yarncrook, and then 10 minutes in, it's not going the way the coach likes, so it's just an absolute jumbo like mix of the lines. The bingo balls come out, and then it's like, what are we doing here? So that's the question. Does the mixing and matching need to stop?
KCB. Well, yeah, I think that's a legitimate question. I think it will at some point. I'm not as concerned with that because there's still 12 games left. And there's they turned over. They brought in 6 new players.
I get it.
6 veteran players. This was always going to happen. He was always going to mix and match and try to get. This is effectively the preseason now because you've got 12 games left. Yes, you're fighting for home ice, and I think that's important for sure. But I think Keefe and company are treating this effectively like the exhibition season. And what I mean by that is trying to find out who works. You're trying to stay healthy. You're trying to find a rhythm, and you're trying to find some cohesion. And at some point, you definitely want to go in feeling good. You don't want to go in losing and feeling bad about your game. And I think recently there are concerns that they haven't been playing as well, the last 2 games in particular. But I think this continues probably for a couple of games, and that was probably always the plan. You know, give Keefe 8 to 12 games to kind of move pieces around, accumulate some looks, accumulate some data, and then filter things out. I believe he has an idea of what he thinks the line's going to look like. I think he's got a pretty good idea of what he thinks 1 through 4 is going to look like and the 3 deep pairings. It can change based on injury and if someone plays really well or someone plays really poorly. But generally, like in the exhibition season, you show up at camp, they know who's starting night 1. Like, for the most part, they know. And I think Keefe has got a pretty good understanding of that. And he's moving pieces around. If they bring the kid in, if they sign Nyes and he shows up, guess what? He's going to move around. So it's frustrating, I'm sure, for the players. I think there's a human element at play here for the players because I think it is difficult. You guys can speak to it. You bring 6 new vets into a room. There's a different vibe. There's a different lineup every night. I think there's an element of boredom with the regular season, which is on display, right? They just want to get to the finish line here and play Tampa. And, you know, it wasn't a great game. I'm with you in terms of breaking down what happened. That wasn't a gruesome forecheck by the Islanders. The Camp giveaway was.
He said,
get rid
afraid.
Of this puck. Absolutely. Yeah. That's the only one. But the Liljegren turnover, that's twice in a week and a half he's done that. He did it in overtime Was it Colorado, I think he did it against, where he had too much time and panicked. The Mitch Marner pass, just because he did it last night doesn't mean he's going to do it in game four, you know, in a month.
Yeah.
Or game. I don't care about the turnovers. Like, the turnovers were silly. They shouldn't happen.
I know you don't care about it. I'm just telling you, that was my breakdown of what happened.
Yeah, no, I agree that and it happened, and they have a history of it. And it has been there before with players on this team. There's no question. What I'm saying is trying to figure out, like, what happened last night, or what happened in Ottawa, or what happened in Edmonton, and trying to apply it to potential issues down the road. I don't see last night's mistakes as something that I'm circling saying, that's really concerning. I think what Keefe said after the game about them not getting to the middle of the ice enough, that's something worthy of talking about. That is something that I guarantee you he's preaching daily, because come playoff time, the Colorado game's going to show up. The Islander game's going to show up. The ice is going to shrink. You know, who's got the ability to get inside?
My thing watching it last night, you're right, I don't care. Like, these are one-offs. You can have a game where you're world beaters, and you can have a game where you don't have it that night and there's some mental errors. The way I look at it is I want to see the players playing to their capability or feeling good about their game. What's happened is recently it's 91, it's 88, mm-hmm. 58.
And
you know,
Tavares was invisible last night.
Right, like,
and
they're invisible. But that's the thing, like, and you can tell the way that Sheldon's trying to get them going. It's like, okay, we're going to mix and match here. Like, near the end of the game, he's got Tavares and Nylander out with 2 minutes left. Nylander's trying to score, like, from bad angles, trying to rip one in. You can tell he's trying to, like, force things to get his confidence back as far as just on the score sheet. Because, it's been a bit of a dip recently. All I would care for the Leafs is that your top players are feeling good about their game. They're confident. They know, you know, what's going on. You're going to have a stretch of a week here, a couple games here or there. I'm not too worried about that watching it. And you're going to play against spoilers. You're going to play against a hot goaltender. You're going to play against desperate teams that need it. You need to feel good about your game. And that being said, there's some guys that aren't playing up to their capability right now. That's more concerning than anything else.
Yes, and the finding the lines and the cohesion, that there is definitely value in that. And Keefe has to understand that, and he's got to find it. Like, the constant shuffling, I don't know if it's a scenario where the players, you know, they're confused with what's coming, they're not sure what to expect, because, you know, that is absolutely a priority. But I think, you know, I was watching the game last night and seeing the reaction, and it's like I'm the one that's trying to, like, settle down here, which I think is rich if you've been following this show for a long time. I'm more than prone to freak out about games like what happened last night. But I think, you know, we're talking 70 games where they've been very good. They will continue to be very good. There's a lot of turnover. They know who they're playing. Like, all of these different things I think factor into possibly what we've seen the last couple of weeks. And I've noticed with fans, like, they're putting the armor up, right? They're putting up a shield where it's almost like you're waiting for things to pop up so you can prepare yourself if they fail again in the playoffs. You know, I've noticed that a lot. Like, you know, it's like a shield of future failure where if they lose, you can say, oh, I knew it because I knew it after the Islander game. I didn't like the way they played. Or when I saw them in Ottawa,
I knew it. Hayes, and you've always said, like, as crazy as that train of thought is, there is a reason for it. Like, there is a reason for the goofiness and the overreaction and building an excuse right now. It's because there's been a lot of nonsense that's gone
absolutely
on here for a lot of years.
Well, it's about protecting yourself as a fan. That is precisely what it is. It is protecting yourself for if your soul gets crushed again, where you try to convince yourself, even though you don't believe it, oh, I don't think it's going to work. And with higher expectations, you got to put even more of a shield up. Because I think there's a lot of fans that are freaking out. They're like, I like that O'Reilly deal. Charlie's been pretty good. That piece works. Like, what if they beat Tampa? What if they go on a run? And it's almost like you prepare yourself for it to fall off the cliff because it has in the past. And I think that's leading to a lot of panic right now that if you take a step back, I don't think it applies in Tampa. I don't think it applied 3 months ago in Colorado. I think when Boston lost two in a row, no one was freaking. The Leafs are a different beast.
But they're – the anxiety is going to be there regardless because, you know, Tampa loses to Montreal last night. Like, they're not panicking. They know how to play. The big thing is I think we have to be realistic. Going in, I think it's a coin flip series regardless.
Just based like last year.
Just like it was last year, just like we've seen before. you're right. The armor goes up. You can get excited about what you see, but ultimately, you know, if Tampa decides, hey, we're going to give everything we've got here too, and our top players are going to play to our capabilities, like, it is a coin flip. And I think people have to be at peace with that and go, and that's not just this series, okay? You watched that Islander team play last night. I was in Boston. Like, Boston is what they are, and they have been dominant. But, like, that Islander team, the goalie all of a sudden decides, hey, I'm going to, you know, steal a couple games here. That team's tough to play against. They're kind of gritty and really chip away at you. Like, there's going to be no easy outs. There might be sweeps, but I don't think there's going to be easy outs on paper.
Absolutely.
And on both sides. So,
yes, I agree. And, like, the Sorokin stop on Gustafson last night was unbelievable. That's the stop of the year. And if that goes in, it's 2-0. And then who knows?
Looks different.
What happens from there? So listen, the Leafs. Once Marner turned the puck over and it was 4-2, the game was over.
Like, that's right.
Whether it's 4-2, 7-2, the game was over.
But you're right about that save, Hazy, because if that goes in, then you're pushing a team. You're forcing a team that's not comfortable, kind of opening it up and trying to cheat for offense or create offense, and then that might make them vulnerable, and the Leafs could they could have blown them out. That
absolutely
didn't happen, though.
But
that save
happen
was massive.
And listen, Samsonov, they needed, like, on the second goal, the Liljegren turnover, he's got to stop that. Like, he's got to make that stop. The Clutterbuck tip and the Clutterbuck shot, those are great goals. And even Parise, like, he didn't really get across. Parise kind of hit the left side of the net.
Kind of came back against it. Yeah,
it was kind of strange how he – but credit to Parise, he got a stick on it, which was impressive in the situation. But, you know, it's – listen, they're not playing – great. Like, there's no disputing that. The Leafs are not – it's not as if they feel like they're in juggernaut mode at all. But I think there are reasonable explanations as to why it's happening, and there's still 12 games. And, you know, I think Keith solidifying a lineup – like, even the lines he went with today at practice looked more like what I think is going to happen. Like, he basically filled in O'Reilly on the third line. You know, he Acciari will probably go to the fourth line where Simmons was today. O'Reilly could step in on that third line where Acciari is playing center possibly tomorrow. And even the D pairings that he had today, McCabe, Brody, Riley, Shen, Giordano, Hall, like, I could see that being the case, and you just kind of roll with it here and you see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'd like to see some consistency, though. That's the biggest thing, guys, because I said this the other day on the show. Like, you can't just flick a switch and go, okay, like, this is what it should look like. Everyone just has to have instinct and go out there. Like, again, I keep coming back to it, and I don't want to beat a dead horse. You watch Boston, those guys, it's no look passes. It's no, like, they know exactly where each other's going to be because they played together for the most part outside of injuries. Like, the D partners have comfort level. You know, the goalie knows how to exchange with the D because they play together for 3 to 5 years. Like, it's like a machine, and the Leafs have to develop that machine, and you can't just do it in a week stretch. Like, it has to be instinct. So I'd like to see a 10-game stretch here where it's like, that's not changing, especially, like, farther down in the lineup. Like, I'd like to see a third line, a fourth line, it's going to look like nightly,
I think so.
You know?
I think with the pairings, too. Like, McCabe, he's had some ups and downs, and I think they got to find who he's playing with, and if Shen's going to play, get him playing with who he's going to play with. Like, those are two new guys who are stepping in. Let them find some cohesion with their partner and try to lock that in. Like, at some point, you're going to have to make a determination. Who are your six guys? Like, who do you think you're going with? And if you're going to hurt some feelings by telling a guy, sorry, you're not playing, you know, for the next 5 games because this is what we have to do, then that's what you have to do. You know, it's the National Hockey League, and you got a lot on the line starting in a few weeks. So Dave Pullen will join us just after 5 o'clock. Jerry's percentages in about an hour. Jerry will be on the show at 5:30. We're looking forward to that. But Mike Farron is coming up of MLB Network. He was calling the game last night, Japan getting past the States. We'll get his take on watching Ohtani live, Ohtani versus Trout in the ninth, what Buster Olney had to say about how much money Ohtani could get in his next deal. You're going to want to hear this. We'll get to that more next.
Hazy, your boy Billy Zaltz is up to his old tricks at the match play. And I'm telling you, he might set a record for he'll never be given a putt. I'm not kidding. If it was 4 inches away, I'm making Billy Zaltz putt it because he's almost missing the ball. I watched one where he looked and he shook his head, and it was like he lifted up and almost missed it completely. I have never seen anything like it.
What was he doing there? Can you get in big trouble for that or no?
No, because with the match play, he had lost the hole, so he just grabbed the ball. Like, he had to hit the putt to tie the hole, the one that's
right, and missed it and pulled it back. Yeah,
yeah, he was pissed. But, like, it was that, to O's point.
But there was other ones, man. That
there, there have been others. But if that's John Rahm, that's Scheffler, his opponent probably says, pick it up. You know, it's a 2.5-footer. Go ahead. Like, concede. We'll give you that. Right. Maybe not, depending on where the match is. But Bill Zalatoris... he put a 15-foot putt on a 2-footer. Like, he blew that past the hole. Like, it wasn't even close.
Dude, there was one a little bit earlier or a little bit later where the commentator said, he's like, oh, he's going to make Billy putt that. And this guy putted it. He took it back. It looked like he was doing the Macarena, okay? He does the Macarena. He draws the putter back, and his neck, like, moved. And he almost missed the ball. Like, it was a shanked putt. And it almost missed from, less than a foot.
Yeah, he's got a really weird jig on the putting stroke now.
But and it's a if stab. You give him a 30-foot putt, he's Ben Dial. Crenshaw. He's beautiful. He's the boss of the moss. But you get him around 5 feet or a foot or something, this guy goes straight into whiskey hands mode.
Yeah.
It's scary stuff.
No, it's not good. When you're on tour and you're stabbing at 3-footers, that is really, really concerning. It wasn't good. It's not good for Will Zalatoris. But we'll continue to track, you know, where he's at and where the rest of the match play is going as it's a Wednesday start, goes all weekend. They play a lot of golf down in Austin. And they've been playing a lot of baseball, and the World Baseball Classic is now officially behind us. And the scene in the ninth, like, that's what everyone wanted. We talked about it extensively today. We wanted to see Ohtani against Trout in a big moment.
Can I say one thing about this, Hayes? People are freaking out, like, NHL, you better do this. Look how awesome this was. Ohtani versus Trout. Like, the one thing you have to say about this could have been a much lesser light matchup where the interest might not have. So they caught a break.
Yes. Like, oh, absolutely.
They caught a break that these two baseball powers and the excitement and Trout versus Ohtani, and they got the matchup to end the game. And I thought it was awesome. I loved it. But it's like, it might not have been that. It might have been.
No, for sure. For sure.
They struck gold, man.
And those guys play in the abyss. Like, their organization couldn't be. Are they in your top five for relevance or non-relevance?
Not necessarily, because they're called LA now. Like, back when they were just Anaheim, they might have been in the bottom five. But that was their World Series. That was the Angels World Series last night.
If you're a part of the Angels, you were watching Ohtani throw his glove and throw his hat and say, and Mike Trout and the emotion. And you're saying, what the hell have we done here the last 5 years?
Completely wasted the two best talents in baseball.
Scary.
And it was a scene in Miami last night. The man that was calling it on MLB Network is Mike Farron, and he joins us now. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
Doing very well. Obviously, as O just said, I mean, it really set up beautifully. It could have been a blowout for Japan, a blowout for the U.S. It could have been, you know, any combination of teams. It could have been Ohtani coming in the fifth or the seventh. It worked out beautifully, though, with Ohtani on the mound, 3-2 game, Trout up at the plate. Like, the atmosphere in the building, what was it like calling that? What was it like witnessing it and just the magic, the theater of it all coming together?
I mean, I'm going to say, first and foremost, I feel so fortunate to have been in the building last night. You know, one of the keys, I think, to doing great radio broadcasts for baseball is being on site and in ballparks and being able to feed off the emotions of what's happening in the stadium, in addition to being able to have the access that is afforded us. You know, as rights holders, we get a little added benefit even when clubhouses are closed, to be able to talk to some people ahead of the game. So all of that was huge. You know, I think back to those times when I had to do radio games off of monitors and how difficult it was, and how I wouldn't be able to answer the question the same way, because for me, this experience of doing the entire WBC was incredible. And the atmosphere in the ballpark did not disappoint. Really, the 5 nights in Miami, all told, were sensational. This year it was a little different because there was not one of the Latin American teams playing, but you got senses of what it was like to be in a game with Team Japan. You know, one of the things I had heard about them in pool play was that when Japan is pitching, this is from the announcers who were in the ballpark, that there was very quiet, right? And so in the first couple of innings, it was kind of eerily quiet, especially when you consider that, like, the Venezuela-U.S. game was 3.5 hours of noise, like just constant noise, right? So that was kind of cool. And then obviously U.S. crowds are kind of more conditioned to when something good is about to happen or when there's a big moment, you stand up and cheer, and so you have that. But the intensity, the atmosphere, all of it, and when you started to figure out about the seventh inning that, hey, there's a chance that this is going to finish with Trout and Ohtani facing each other in the ninth, I mean, that just drove it home. It was the perfect cap to what was a really remarkable 2 weeks of baseball.
Mike, we were just talking about the Angels and watching those two superstars, as you just mentioned, Ohtani and Trout. Like, if you've been involved with the Angels in the last 5 years, you must look at that and say, how disappointing for the organization not to get that club. And I understand that they're the players and they were a part of it, but for them to not be involved in big games in the playoffs, it's got to be so disappointing.
Sure. I think everybody involved in that organization would tell you that. I think that's something that, you know, Perry Manassian's in his third year as the general manager there. I think that's something that he obviously feels because I think he understands the importance of it. But I think an event like this is bigger than what we have in Major League Baseball. And I think what you're talking about is seeing two superstars, two of the maybe the five best players ever. I mean, Babe Ruth wishes he could have done the stuff that Ohtani's doing, right? Like, he wasn't a two-way player the same amount of time that Ohtani was. Trout's probably the best all-around player since Willie Mays. Like, you're talking about those two guys going head-to-head for their countries. That's a little bit different beast. And so, yeah, I think absolutely the Angels are probably part of you going, man, it would be so great to see these guys in the postseason. But for what this did for baseball internationally and for what this moment was by itself, I think this was really, really special that we were able to see it.
We're chatting with Mike Farron. He called the game for MLB Network last night. Japan getting past the U.S. 3-2 at the World Baseball Classic Final. And the buildup of it, you mentioned by the seventh inning, you could start to do the math and kind of see where it was going. Mm-hmm. And then when Ohtani comes out, you realize, all right, you know, Mookie hits into the double play. It's Trout, do or die. He's got to get a hit to stay alive or at least walk. It worked. It was perfect theater. But then when you actually watch the at-bat, like, Trout is, you know, one of the all-time greats. And the old saying, you know, the greatest of all time fails 7 times out of 10. He wasn't even close, man. Like, Ohtani, and it's not about dragging Trout. I think what was symbolized last night was the greatness of Ohtani. Like,
he 100-mile-an-hour fastball.
He's challenging him. Like, he's blowing it past him. Yeah. And that slider, that was a violently ill slider to punch him out. That third strike was disgusting. And like,
I think
that,
somebody said that it had 18 inches of movement on it, which is like one inch further than the plate. So, right? So think about that. That started inner third for Trout. And, like, you're expecting 100, right? You see it coming out of the hand. You're thinking it's a fastball. And he's got a fastball swing on it, and the next thing you know, it's in the left-handed batter's box, right? But to your point, like, 100 miles an hour from Ohtani in Trout's wheelhouse was the 1-0 pitch. Trout's one of the greatest low-ball hitters ever, right? And there was a pitch that was just below the 5, middle of the plate, at like 101. I think it was the 1-0 pitch that he swung through. And that was so cool in watching Ohtani challenge him with that. That was neat. And a couple of the takes that Trout had were very confident, right? Maybe the first pitch breaking ball, he got a slider on the first pitch. And he had a real confident take, like, yep, I got that. I mean, like, if you really go back and look through the way that both of those guys acted in that at bat, it was terrific drama. It was two guys who were locked the heck in and ready and knew. I mean, they knew what the moment meant. They didn't have to be told. And I'm sure Trout was counting outs, too. And I'm sure Ohtani was counting batters as well and trying to figure out if this was going to happen because they knew this is what everybody wanted before the tournament. I mean, it's like it's a one-in-a-million shot almost that we got.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that the Major League Baseball can carry this built momentum into the season and maybe capitalize on it?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think there's certainly buzz surrounding it, right? It almost thinks we can't start the season tomorrow,
right?
That we have another week of spring training. But, you know, my hope is with that and with, you know, probably some casual fans that were watching it internationally who had a chance to you know, see the excitement of it, that they can get behind some of the rule changes and the quicker tempo that should be coming between pitches this year, and seeing if maybe they're interested in staying involved. You know, like I can, this is something that I do know as a fact. So we talked about it on the broadcast last night. So I don't know if you guys remember the 2009 World Baseball Classic, but Darvish actually closed out their win over South Korea. And a number of the Japanese pitchers are in their early 20s. And they said they remember being in elementary and grade school watching that happen. And that was a big moment for them, right? So one, first of all, thinking that 2009 was far enough away from this moment that there are guys that are pitching who are in elementary school now was a really difficult pill to swallow for me, because it meant that I am really old. But the other part of it is, like, how many of those players are in that spot? How many players were watching Trey Turner, you know, the other night? Or watching, you know, like even going back to pool play, right? Like watching Otto Lopez, you know, and watching Team C in the matchup against Columbia, right? Who saw these moments, who got into baseball or got a little bit of the itch that they now want to take forward into the regular season. I think that's something that I'm excited to see. I don't know where that goes. I don't know how that works in North America compared to Japan. But I do think it's interesting to think that, you know, that there were probably some lifelong fans that were made over the course of this event because of the intensity of it, because of the star power, because of the quality of play.
Well, it was an incredible finish and an incredible buildup. And like you mentioned, the crowds in Miami, it was all you could ask for out of an event. And they've committed to it. They will continue to commit to it. And we look forward to the next one. He is Mike Farron of MLB Network Radio. He was calling it last night. Great job. Really appreciate you taking time. And we'll do this again down the road. Thank you, Mike.
All right, guys. Take care.
There he is, Mike Farron.
Was that a great job last night or great job?
Just in general. No, yeah, I thought great job with the hit. I thought it was great job with the hit.
Oh, I thought it was kind of. I thought it was kind of like your Nazem Kadri thing, where it's like, stay fit,
stay. Well, is that what he said? Stay fit.
He did.
Stay active. I said stay active. That was, and I thought that was an important message. Right? It was during COVID early on. I don't know what Naz was doing.
Should have said that to him this off season.
Yes, after signing that big deal, I don't know how active he was after that.
Exactly. I'll tell you what, that Ohtani man, like he's the kind of athlete and player where if you're the casual kind of Toronto Jays fan, he could almost make you buy the MLB package in the nights that he's pitching out west. Like, just tune in. Like, he's that guy.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. That's what it was about last night. Like, Trout is an all-time great. Trout is a beast, and Trout has been so dialed in during that tournament, and he'll have a great season. If he's healthy, he's going to be one of the five best players in the game. But that was the Ohtani show. Like, Ohtani won the MVP for the team that won. He was the best batter, is the best pitcher. Like, this stat has been going around, you know, online everywhere, that Mike Trout has had 6,174 career MLB plate appearances. So over 6,000 times he's come to the plate. Only 24 times has he swung and missed three times for strikes. That's what happened last night. That's how great Ohtani is.
That's a great stat.
It's an incredible stat.
That's unbelievable.
You cannot make – you can't fool Mike Trout three times. You can strike him out, but he's going to foul off a pit. He didn't even make contact last night. Did not make contact. Just three swings, three misses, and, I mean, that's all you need to know about this cat, Ohtani. The guy can hit 40 bombs and pitch like that. It is something we've never seen before.
Yeah. But they're teammates, too, which – what's crazy – you should know each other's, like, tendencies. Like, he should know Ohtani inside and out and vice versa, but Ohtani got the best of him.
I don't think it matters, Noodles. That's the thing. If the guy's throwing 101 on the paint and then throwing a slider that moves as much as that slider moved, it doesn't matter if you know it's coming. Like, that was like a Wild Thing versus Parkman last night in Major League. Like, if you can hit it, you can name it, and Trout could not hit it. And Ohtani's deal is up after this year. Buster Olney of ESPN was on First Up this morning. Let's hear what he had to say. Listen to this number he throws out about how much Ohtani possibly could sign for.
The question at that point is the offer that he signs start with the number 5 or start with the number 6? $500 million plus, $600 million plus. I think it's going to be $600 million plus because there's nobody else in baseball that can do what he can do, that can replicate his production, replicate his marketability. We're going to be talking about him through the trade deadline. We're going to be talking about him going into the offseason and all the way through free agency. Mets, Dodgers, maybe the Yankees, maybe the Mariners, and the Angels trying to keep him. He's going to have enormous bidding for the best player in the world.
Wow. $600 million. That's if you do the math, he's talking a 12-year deal. You're talking $50 million a year. $50 cash.
What if somebody just says, screw it, we'll give you $1 billion?
That's what I was thinking. Like
how far away are we from that? Like, just give him $1 billion.
Well, when you were building that story up, when you were building that, you know, hey, this sound clip, I'm like, is it $1 billion? Like, I that's all I could think about.
Do you think a player in our lifetime will sign for $1 billion?
Yes.
Dude, when you have a special talent like that that's off the charts, I don't know how far we would be away from it, but
okay, so
you would have to think an organization like the Jays, maybe the Yankees, the Giants out in San Francisco, they would probably sit in a boardroom saying, should we just offer this guy $1 billion? Now, is it worth it to us to bring this cat in for $1 billion?
$1 billion is Dr. Evil type negotiations.
No, I know, but define, okay, so define sport, because wasn't Ronaldo just sniffing around that? Like,
yeah, but that was for like $250 million or something. And not that that's something to sneeze at, but and not nearly as many years.
But that's what I'm saying. If a guy goes, I'll sign a lifetime contract and let's say 15 years from now, so in our lifetime, hopefully, knock on wood for all of us, like 20 years from now, like salaries are going to continue to escalate, everything, inflation, all of that. Like I could see somebody being a $75 million player, $100 million player season. So you sign a 10 or 12 year deal at that type, like that's $1 billion.
Could you imagine trying to work out a salary cap sheet with a guy making $100 million?
Well, dude, Hayes, if he came to the Jays, let's say he came to the Jays, what is it worth having that guy playing ball down the street?
A fortune. The amount of tickets, the amount of merchandise, what you get out of the Japanese market is where the real money's at, because that cat is the biggest thing.
He's a god.
He is absolutely massive over there, and it's a huge country. It's a country that loves sports, loves baseball, loves Ohtani. So if you're the Jays, you know, there's Jays jerseys all over Japan. You know, you'd be selling them everywhere. I can't monetize it. I can't tell you exactly what it would be. But if it hits 600, like forget $1 billion, it's not going to be $1 billion. But 600 is a landmark. Like that's wild money, man. $600 million. Imagine signing a contract with $600 million on it.
Yeah, he's going to.
He's going to. And I'm telling you, in our lifetime, we are going to see salaries continue to escalate and get out of control. But I mean, that's where these sports are going.
If the owners are going to pay.
Exactly.
And the owners are making money, right? Like all these franchises are being sold for $2, $3, $4 billion.
Exactly.
That's going to keep going up for sure. Dave Pullen in about 20 minutes. Jerry's percentages. I wonder how Jerry would feel about someone signing for $1 billion in the NHL. He's coming up at 5:30. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on TSN 2. All right, we have a pair of tickets to give away. Leafs Blue Jackets, April 4th, every day this week. We will provide the clue to the identity of a current or ex-Maple Leaf player. And on Friday, you'll have a chance to call in and name that Leaf. Today's clue. This former Maple Leaf played in the Stanley Cup Final one time. One-time Stanley Cup Final. Everything is leading in one direction, but I don't know. It could be throwing people off.
I think it's a trick question. Whoever does this is a rod or whatever. He's trying to mess with us. That's what he's doing.
I don't think it's you, O. I don't. In fact, I know really? It's not based on, there was a clue yesterday, and I don't think you were in the same ballpark.
The clue yesterday.
That clue.
What was the clue yesterday?
Penalty minutes. Something about penalty minutes. And I don't, how many did you have in your career?
Me?
Yeah.
I for no fights, I had a lot of penalties.
Yeah, I was going to say he probably had 400 or 500. Did you not? Oh,
probably that.
Yeah,
actually, here's what I was going to say.
You, actually.
What if it was like he once had a mascot named Stormy the Pig? Isn't that the pig?
Stormy the Pig.
Yeah. I saw him last time I was there.
That guy still is around? That's still their guy? Stormy the Pig?
I think it's a pig, isn't it?
He's a legend. He's a legend.
Yeah. Is that based on the Piggly Wiggly being from the Carolinas? Like, isn't that the Piggly Wiggly, isn't that in from North Carolina?
He had nothing to do with Piggly Wiggly, the store. They just decided the mascot was going to be a pig.
I see. Okay. Piggly Wiggly's a gritty little place, man. I don't know if they're still around. I haven't been down there in a long time, but Piggly Wiggly.
You could get in some trouble there, I think.
You can get in some trouble at the Piggly Wiggly. Yes, yeah. you definitely can.
670 minutes in PIMS.
670 for you. That's pretty good. Like, that's a lot of time in the sin.
What was the clue yesterday?
It was something about penalty minutes, but I don't remember the number. So it was probably around that. It's trending towards you.
Yeah, like it is.
Still is probably trending in your direction. Day pooling coming up, and Jerry's percentages at 5:30. Overdrive continues. TSN 1050 and on TSN 2.